Thank you very much, and welcome to this very special prom for Sunday afternoon here at the Albert Hall, which has been transformed for one day only into the best family party you'll ever see or hear. Yes, this isn't your usual prom. We at Radio 3 are proud to present the Wallace and Gromit prom, the Wallace and Promit. On stage, we got the splendid Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin, who is not an animated figure, but a real-life person. Later, he will be animated, of course, but in a musical way. He'll also be introducing the pieces for us. Backstage, here at the Albert, are Wallace and Gromit, who've devised this afternoon's concert, and it's their responsibility to manage everything in a Wallace and Gromit fashion, of course. Wallace has pimped his piano, as we say at Radio 3, so it's now a V8 hot rod piano, and Gromit has taken up the violin. He owns a priceless Stradivarius and is obviously the one with the talent. They're linked by a bright red phone to Nicholas Collins' conductor's podium. And it's not a usual podium either. It's been specially designed and built by Wallace and Gromit, and it comes complete with a place to put your cup of tea and plate of crackers and a pneumatic delivery tube for sending messages and even pieces of sheet music and scores. And it's always exciting to be at the Albert Hall, but there's a special kind of excitement this afternoon, I think. It's magnificent to see these families here. I've been watching them walking in, and the sight of young children when it's their first time at the Albert Hall, to see their eyes wide open, their mouths open, just at the magnificence that is the Albert Hall. Those of us who come here often forget what a fantastic, fantastic place it is. That applause there is for the leader of the Aurora Orchestra, Thomas Gould, who's receiving the applause with a kind of gentle bow. And so we welcome Nicholas Collin on stage to conduct the orchestra for the first music, appropriately, The Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for a very special prom. We'll be going on a journey this afternoon through some wonderful orchestral music with Aurora Orchestra behind me here, including the premiere of a new piece for piano and orchestra. It's called My Concerto in E-Lat. It's by a composer I admit I'd never heard of before. It goes by the name of Wallace. Now Wallace, it turns out, is famous for being an ingenious inventor. And his friend Gromit, it appears, is a dog. But did you know they're both great music lovers? Now, Gromit has a record collection, really second to none. It's been a huge privilege for us to work so closely with him in selecting the repertoire for today's concert. And they've both been helping us prepare for the final event. Now, when I got here this morning, I discovered this rather strange-looking contraption. It's really unlike any conductor's podium I've ever seen before. It comes with some instructions from Wallace. I'll read them to you. Maestro-matic. Don't just beat time, beat arm ache too. Comes with a handy baton holder and even somewhere to put your mug of tea if you fancy a cup during one of those long Wagner operas. Oh, and a plate of crackers to keep you going. How very thoughtful of him. And speaking of which, we should probably crack on. Sorry, I'm not quite sure what that is. It's probably a phone. Hello?
Well, this is a fine how-to-do, isn't it? Not much of a conductor, is he, lad? Haven't seen him punch a single ticket.
Hello, it's Nick here.
Oh, hello. Can you put me on speaker?
You really are already on speaker.
Ah, good. Ladies and gentlemen, Wallace here. I'm sorry I can't be with you, but I'm backstage, personally overseeing the final preparations for my special performance. I've also been making some improvements to ensure the show runs a little smoother. So, without further ado, I'll hand you back to the conductor, so have your tickets ready. bye for now.
Well, thanks for that, Wallace. As I was saying, it's time for our next piece. Now, at the beginning of the concert, we heard Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, in honor, really, of Wallace, the ultimate common man. Now, to recognize his skill as an inventor, I've got the perfect piece by American composer John Adams. It's called A Short Ride in a Fast Machine. Have you all got your music? Got your music? I don't have my music. Excuse me, everyone.
The phone's ringing, lad. Don't worry, I'll get it. Wallace and Gromit, musical marvels. Making music marvellous.
Wallace, it's Nick again. I thought this maestro-matic was all set to go. Oh. I can't find my next piece of music anywhere.
Oh, really? Are you quite sure?
I'm absolutely sure. I've looked all over my stand.
Not to worry. My trusty assistant and I will have another copy with you in a jiffy. Won't we, Gromit?
Well, he'd better do, or this could get very embarrassing.
Doesn't he know who I am? I was commissioned by Sir Albert Hall himself. It's nice to see my true genius being recognized at last. Thanks, lad. That conductor will soon be whistling a different tune.
Here it is, finally. John Adams, Short Ride in a Fast Machine. Now, if you listen carefully, it's as if the orchestra is one huge machine traveling incredibly quickly. It's all held together by one instrument, the first instrument you hear. It's the smallest instrument in the orchestra, and that's the woodblock.
Thank you.
Not bad, I suppose. But wait till they hear my piece, Gromit. Wallace's piano concerto in E-lad. Ooh, speaking of which, how's that piano coming along? Come on, lad, put some welly into it. Oh, heck! Oh, that's just grand. Here, maybe we can jimmy it out with this. This'll do the trick. Hey, it's only an old one, lad. Don't worry. I'll soon remedy this. I'll never get this show on the road. But maybe...
Well, I hope they're doing all right getting a piano ready for Wallace's piece. Anyway, next up is something that Gromit was very keen on including. It's a virtuoso showpiece for his favorite instrument, the violin. Now, this is Ciardas by little-known Italian composer Vittorio Monti. So let's please welcome special guest Tasman Little.
joyous applause there for Tasman Little, who's just been playing the Monty's Shardash. Fantastic piece. You'll have heard the amazing reaction when we see the film here at the Albert Hall, when Wallace and Gromit, who really are backstage, are suddenly portrayed on the middle of a screen in the audience. And the actual reaction from the audience was fantastic, because to start with, when we only heard them on the telephone, we thought, well, what's actually happening here? Are we going to see them? So when they appeared, the joy in the audience was marvellous. There's a baby quite near me who was asleep at the start, who was having amazing dreams about Wallace and Gromit, and then woke up and saw Wallace and Gromit on the screen. We're now just having a slight break between the pieces, and the audience, they're the opposite of restless. They're restful, they're waiting, they're ready for the next piece. Sometimes at this kind of concert, people get a bit restless and they start moving about, but there's none of that here. There are one or two grandmas fishing in the cardigans for sweets to give the children. The baby was asleep, has now nodded off again and will wake up again shortly. There are people talking to each other about what they've just heard. And that's the great thing about the proms at the Albert Hall, that there's this informal atmosphere where people can talk about what they've just heard. The orchestra now tuning up again, and Nicholas will be back on the stage with us shortly. That is a great sound, an orchestra tuning up. In any other form, you don't get that. You don't get actors taking deep breaths on stage in full view of the audience. You don't get writers sharpening the pencils just before they start writing poems. But the great thing about an orchestral concert, I always think, particularly one like this, in front of a family audience, is that they see the orchestra getting ready. They see the nuts and bolts of the piece. They see the actual mechanics. They see the workings of an orchestra. A lot of these people may not have seen an orchestra before, may only have heard it on Radio 3 or on disc, but now they're seeing what a magnificent machine an orchestra is, a kind of machine with a soul and a machine with a heart. So it's a visual thing, it's a thing you can watch as well as a thing you can listen to. So round here, those grandmas were fishing sweets out of the cardigans, and the sleeping baby, and the extended families, they're all looking now, they're all gazing in wonder at what's happening on the stage, which may not appear to be very much, but in fact it is. You can see violinists just adjusting little bits of strings. You can see brass players doing that thing where they take the mouthpiece out and they start blowing into it a little bit, and they're shaking bits of spittle from the end of their instruments, and audiences are getting, they're excited by that. There's a real sense of palpable excitement in the room, even though there's not actually very much happening. And again, that's the fantastic thing about the proms, about the Albert Hall, about the idea that here we are in a place where lots of things happen and lots of things are about to happen. That's always the sense with an orchestral concert. Something's happened, something's about to happen. I don't know if it's a problem with the crackers on the plate. I suggest it could be. I think somehow maybe the crackers on the plate that were placed there before have somehow come loose, and there's something wrong with the crackers. That may be the thing. One or two of the younger people and people with fishing little handkerchiefs out of their cardigans are taking the opportunity to visit the facilities. That's why I'm speaking very quietly, because as you know, with a children's concert, you mustn't mention visiting the facilities. Here's Nicholas Cullen back on. I think he's solved the problem with the crackers on the plate. I'm sure he has.
That's what happens if you leave preparations to Wallace and Gromit. Anyway, where were we? So thanks, that was Chardas by Vittorio Monti, beautifully played by Tasman Little. Now I imagine, believe it or not, that Wallace and Gromit probably needs even more time to get everything ready for their piano concerto. So I thought we'd take a little look down memory lane. Now both Wallace and Gromit have had their fair share of nasty exploits, meeting some pretty horrible creatures, and some fairly nasty characters crop up in orchestral music too. The Firebird by Russian composer Igor Stravinsky tells the story of evil King Katchai, who wants to turn Prince Ivan into stone. Ivan produces a magical feather from the Firebird, which forces Katchai and his followers into a frenetic dance. Perhaps Wallace could have used that trick in some of his adventures. Thank you. Fierce music from Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. Now, over the years, we've also seen Wallace's softer side. Now, I know he's proved to be a bit of a catch with the ladies. To celebrate that, we're going to play one of the most romantic pieces of classical music ever written. Claude Debussy's Clair de Lune, or Moonlight, was originally written for piano, but here we'll play it in a version for orchestra. Speaking of piano, I wonder how they're getting on back there.
Stand back, lad! Say hello to my petrol-powered piano. It's a classic. It's got a remote control, too. Woohoo! Oh, dear. The ones that got away. Ah, well. No use crying over spilt milk. Hey! Romit! You'd better get this patched up pronto. They need the lights. Oh, I knew I should have put new batteries on the shopping list. Oh no, they've started already. Here, pass me a spare fuse, lad. Oh, crumbs. They're in my toolbox. Hold the fort, lad. I'll be back in a mo. Oh, look, a shortcut. It's a good job I know this place like the back of my hand. Ow! Oh, I must have been looking at the wrong hand. Oh, I've twanged me G-string. Don't worry, Gromit. I've got it.
Well, that was half the overture to Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. And thank goodness the lights are all back on now. We'll definitely need them on full power for our next piece. This is an excerpt from the Fourth Symphony by Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. Now, this bit of music is called a fugue. In fact, you just saw one there. You saw one with the lights going around the strings. A fugue is a little bit like a musical version of a chase. Now, I know Wallace and Gromit have both had their fair share of chases in their time. So the fugue, or chase, starts up here in the first violins. Once they've set off, it passes to the violas over here, then to the second violins, and lastly, to the cellos. But before that, before we hear the fugue, we're going to play the short, grotesque march before it. Listen out for the shrill wind and menacing brass.
Come on, Gromit. It's nearly time for my concerto. And I've programmed the piano to play itself. Here, listen. Eh?
Huh? Oh, crotchets! It's castratoed! Oh, it's Opus, lad. My masterpiece is in pieces. What are we to do? Hmm?
So it's nearing the moment we've all been waiting for. The piano should be ready any time soon. And I, for one, can't wait to... What on earth is that again? A telegram from Wallace. Maestro, stop. The concerto, no can do. Stop. Sorry, technical hitch. You'll have to fill... Stop. Do you know any good tunes? Over. Well, does anyone know any good tunes? Thanks, Simon, but I think we've had that one already, and we're going to have it again in the concert. Could get a little tedious. But I tell you what, the last bar in that tuba sounded pretty good. Can you just give us that again, Richard? I think we might have the makings of a piece. Should we just try that, but not in the tuba? Try it in the double bass. That's more like it. Let's add a little bit of rhythm on the kit. Now, this could go on all day, so we probably need a tune. How about something from the flute? You'll recognise that, I hope. Nice, bit of Mozart, but not quite right. We need something with a bit more swing. I know, the clarinet. Always go to the clarinet if you want some swing. That's it. Now, why have one clarinet when you can have two? Should we have two? Now, whilst we're in the woodwind section, should we try out the bassoons? I love the bassoons. Here they are. How about some oboes? Let's hear the oboes take flight. And finally, in the woodwind section, we've got four fluttering flutes. Now we've got all the woodwind instruments. Let's hear them playing together as a section, shall we? Great stuff. Let's go over to those shiny-looking gold instruments over there, the brass. But before we do, a brief burst on the saxophone. Now the friendly trombones. And the French horns. Let's see what those trumpets can play. I'm hoping that they can come up with something better than the one at the beginning. Something sort of suave, cool, sophisticated. Let's see. We know that one. Let's hear what happens when we put all the brass family together. Trumpets, trombones, horns, saxophone, and the tuba. After all that big brash brass, let's see what the civilized strings can give us. But having heard that Shostakovich, I'm not sure how civilized they really are. Let's see how fast they can go. One, two, three. Let's add all the woodwind. And some brass. And some percussion and drums. Let's all have a big workout.
Oh, well done, lad. You limber up. I'll get this up top.
Now, I'm hoping this will be the piano concerto from Wallace. And they've got things fixed. No, it's not at all. Double concerto for violin and dog. Not at all what I was expecting. But on closer examination, looks like a fine work. Gromit will be the dog, so we need another violin. I know, I've got just the thing. Tasmin, hi. Are you still in the building? Fantastic. Listen, how do you fancy saving our skins? Be playing a brand new piece, hot off the press. Gromit. That's right, Gromit, yeah. In the big hall. No one's watching. Okay, as soon as you can. Bye. Fancy some crackers. The plate's stuck to the thing, so you'll have to just take some cheese there as well.
Thank you.
Well, that was an action-packed half. Just time for a round of applause for composer Ian Farrington for his fantastic jazz piece earlier. And you may have spotted a tune, I Got Rhythm, by George Gershwin in there as well. Thank you, Ian. And thanks again to Tasmin Little, who saved the day along with Gromit with that rather magnificent rendition of Gromit's double concerto for violin and oboe.
Well done, Matt. We did it! A regular little Puccini, aren't you, Gromit?
So we'll see you after the interval for a matter of loaf and death.
You really will. That was the conductor of the Aurora Orchestra, Nicholas Cohen. Well, that first half was amazing. As a fan of new music, I was really bowled over by Gromit's double concerto for violin and dog. I was going to make a Bach and Offenbach joke there, but of course I won't. So, as Nicholas was saying, we're returning 20 minutes when our plasticine chums are back with their film A Matter of Loaf and Death. But first, in the spirit of our concert, we take a radio journey with the poet and former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen with his interval feature, Wallace and Gromit, A Feat of Clay. Earlier, Michael visited the Aardman Studios in Bristol, where he uncovered some of their putty secrets, and we join him as he enters their hallowed portals.
Who is it?
Michael Rosen from the BBC.
Come in.
I've come to Bristol, to the Aardman Studios, to meet Nick Park, the creator of Wallace and Gromit. And up there on the wall, I can see a huge poster for the pirates in an adventure with scientists. Let's go plundering. That seems to be a cue.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow, here we are. Look, a giant Wallace. Oh, he's as big as me. And he's just holding his hands in that very pernickety way, like he's just about to explain something to Gromit. Gromit's sitting in a chair, not really listening. Gromit's looking right up into the sky. Oh, there's the penguin. Just better be careful of him.
Oh, it's you.
Hello, my name's Merlin, and I'm the creative director of Wallace and Gromit.
So, we've got plenty to talk about. I'd love to see the studios and how you put all this stuff together, how you put this particular show together. So, do we go upstairs, downstairs? Where do we go?
We go out the back to the big studio.
Oh, right. It's like a shed.
A big shed.
Yes. Yeah. I once went to Oliver Postgate's shed, and it really was a shed. Mm. It was just a little shed with string. I think yours is probably a bit bigger than
ours. Ours is an old banana ripening warehouse.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We've got a big open plan office. We're going past two killer rabbits. And then, a windmill. Now, where does that one come from? Remind me, did I miss this one?
Gromit, it's a bomb! The cake's a bomb!
And something like that that's got movement. Mm. Do you film it moving or do you stop frame that?
We'd stop frame that.
And this is a technology that goes all the way back to the beginning of cinema, doesn't it?
It really does.
Say Méliès, so, who was putting...
Méliès, Willis O'Brien, and then Ray Harryhausen, they all perfected essentially the arts that we use today. The core technique hasn't changed, just the technologies with which we capture the images has changed.
Yeah, so when we see King Kong, part of King Kong, that was stop frame. Ray
Absolutely.
Harryhausen, Jason and the Argonauts.
It's our heritage, thanks to them, that we have a vibrant industry.
And let's do a little bit of boasting about the BBC. Tony Hart messing around with Little Morph.
Yes.
There he was with plasticine.
Absolutely. I mean, Morph is a big part of Aardman. And a lot of the older animators cut their teeth. I started on Morph. Nick Park started animating Morph. And so it's really a big part of everybody's life here.
Could I just say it was quite sad when Morph just disappeared into the... tabletop. He would be one moment there, and if you were responsible for that, I think I actually have a bit of a grudge.
To talk to the boss about that.
Yeah, well, I will, because the sight of Morph just sort of disappearing into a pool of plasticine was quite disconcerting for some of us.
He didn't come back?
Well, he did. Yeah. Now you point that out, yes.
But at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite dark.
Yes.
So indeed. Mind where you're putting your feet.
Right.
We'll go on in.
So why have we got several cubicles?
Okay, so we call these units, and each unit would house a scene. In a moment, I'll take you through, and we can see all the Wallace and Gromits that we've got. We have more than one.
Oh,
each.
No! I don't think you should have said that. More than one Wallace and Gromit. It's not possible. So, let's just take a look in here.
Oh, no, Michael, please what? Don't. No, not in there.
How about this one?
Yeah, please do, yeah.
So there's Gromit, no Wallace. Oh, he's with somebody. Who's he with, Merlin?
He's with Julian Knott. He composed the Wallace and Gromit theme tune. They must be helping Wallace out with his new composition.
Not bad, Gromit. Didn't you? Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to decide what style you're going to be in. For example, do you want to be in a sort of modernistic style? Do you want to do a Webern? All right, well, this is more fun. What about Boulez? Okay, Gromit, so you think that's too jumpy and loud. Remember the proms audience? Ah, brass band, right. Well, of course, the good starting point for brass band is some umpah. So do you want to just... Give me your paw, Gromit. Do this. Right, you have a go. No, have another go. Come on, have another go. Very good. Now, the next thing you should do is have a go at putting a melody on. Melodies are good because what you need is a little hook that repeats all the time. So what we have in the Wallace and Gromit tunes is... Of course, what we do is we repeat it all the time. So that's what you should do. So put a little melody on top of that umpah. Have a go. Very good. Do another go?
See, you've got a beautiful little set. I'm just going to cross. Oh, I'm holding him. Oh, my goodness me. I'm actually holding a Wallace, and I can feel his armature, and he is made of plasticine.
Yes, modelling clay.
That's his head coming off.
Yeah, and his head and hands are always modelling clay.
Yeah.
Wallace's tank top is made of a resin, and that's because the pattern on it is so... details that if it was made of modelling clay and you grabbed it, it would get squished. And while you could do that, it would just take so much time to re-sculpt it that we found it's much, much more effective to have it look like modelling clay but be made out of a resin. And his sleeves and hands and Wallace's face are all modelling clay because those are the expressive parts of him, and it's very important that we maintain that.
And those eyeballs, you can move those around, can't
yes.
you?
So the eyeballs are made of resin. They're a resin bead. And so I've got this little tool here that I can stick into his eyeball. If you're squeamish, look away now. And I poke him in the middle of the eye and move his eye to the required position and then take my little pin out.
And then you can get... Can I press
please
down
do,
at the top
make
of him to
cross,
make him...
Yeah.
This makes him cross, does it?
Yeah, there you go.
I know you're doing this for my own good, but the fact is, I'm just crackers about cheese.
And then what do you do? Leave the nose as it is?
Leave the nose as it is, and then if he's speaking, you take his mouth off, and we've got a whole different set of mouth shapes. So when you need to animate speech, you record the dialogue first, and then we have that sound broken down into 25ths of a second, so that the animator knows exactly what phonetic sound is coming out of the character's mouth.
Huh?
And we then have a box of mouths with mouth shapes in. So you might have an oo, or an ah, or a...
Ooh.
And we know that if he's saying hello, the first shape's going to be a ha, it's got a tight mouth shape. And
you're
then you
grinning
have,
when you're saying
yeah,
that, that's a hello.
And then your jaw drops and your mouth stays tight and wide. And then you have L, who you will need to put an L-shaped mouth in, with your tongue sticking out maybe on a more graphic character. And then O, like that. And
oh.
The timings of those mouth shapes will be dictated by the speed at which the word was said. So it might not be a change every frame. You might have your L on for 3 frames and your O on for 5 frames. And the animator will have to work to those timings so that it looks convincing when the character speaks.
Looks convincing, but massively complicated because, you know, when we say a word, quite a lot goes on at the back as well as the front. When you've got the frontal stuff, that's fine. But when you say gurgle, you know, the
front of my... Well, that comes from the physical performance. So when you laugh, maybe if you're going to go, your body rocks before you actually say anything because you're taking in a breath. And when you do that, your body bounces. And it's less about the shape of your mouth and more what the body does. And that's the skill of the animator to interpret that and give the character that movement so that as the audience, you understand it.
How long does it take for an animator to learn to say, animate, hello, everybody, I'm here today, and hello, Gromit? I mean, how long would it take an animator to get that on the face?
When animating Wallace and Gromit, average about 2.5 seconds of finished screen time a day. That's per animator. But in order to get to that level, it's a craft skill, and it takes years and years and years. I mean, it's hard to put an actual figure on it, but I'd say 4 or 5 years would be about right from being a junior animator before you sort of are let loose on hero character animation.
And as you said, I absolutely love that this is old technology. This isn't CGI. I know you sometimes use computer-generated imagery in some of the major features, but the idea that this was something that the old people right at the birth of cinema used, I mean, it's very special, because, I mean, nearly everything has changed in cinema, but this is something from right from the birth of cinema.
We kind of like to go one step further, and we don't get rid of the thumbprints. We really like to see the thumbprints. We like people to see that it's been handmade. We don't try and polish it and make it look really shiny. There's something about the grittiness and the solidity of it being physical, and it's a big part of the whole Wallace and Gromit look and feel.
So I'm going to surrender Wallace back to you so that we can take a little closer look at the set there, because that is, it's like a, oh, something quite, quite beautiful. Just to get the idea of the size of it, we're looking at what's almost like a Pollock's paper theatre. It's about, oh, I don't know, 3 feet across, and we've got a bench, and because Gromit is playing the fiddle beautifully. He's got his head to one side, he's got it tucked under his arm. Wallace has got a pair of cymbals just a little close to Gromit. I'm not sure Gromit's going to be too happy about those cymbals clashing. I think he's going to be patient, but not too happy about it. The music's on the bench, but some of it's scrumpled up. Somebody's not too happy with the composition. And then, perhaps a bit incongruously, we've got a drill, cogs, and some kind of electronic box. So this is not just music going on here. There's several other things.
Yeah, Wallace, he likes to compose where he's most comfortable, and where he's most comfortable is in the workshop. So he tried doing it in the living room and in the kitchen and outside, but the place where he gets his inspiration is down in the workshop. So that's where Wallace went to find the notes within himself.
And did he know that Gromit could play the fiddle perfectly?
Well, Gromit's always messed around with music, and especially the fiddle. It's been a sort of a little hobby of his through the years, and he's only too happy to help Wallace out whenever he needs a bit of advice on music or rummage through his collection of LPs.
Excellent. And there's some gaffer tape in there as well, I think, isn't there, just in case anything falls apart?
Gaffer tape does hold most of the studio together, so it's fitting that there's some in Wallace's studio.
We've got a kind of cyclorama at the back there. It says stage door. Mm. We're at the back of the...
We are backstage or below stage at the Albert Hall here. Yes, so this is Wallace and Gromit getting ready for the big performance.
So where are we going now?
We're going to get in the lift and we're going to go and see the big cheese, Nick Park.
Oh, right, the Wensleydale himself.
Mm-hmm. Le Grand Fromage.
Yeah.
Going up. Second floor, doors open.
Nice to be guided by Wallace even in the lift, isn't it? It's good. I like that. Le Grand Fromage, il est là.
Here he is now.
Here he is.
Nick, come on in.
Hiya.
Wonderful to meet you, sir.
Hello. Nice to meet you too.
Wow, fantastic. Right, we're now up amongst the gods. We've been down in the banana ripening factory, and seen Wallace and Gromit ripening beautifully down there.
Yes.
And I've actually held Wallace. I've held a Wallace, and he's damp, isn't he? To the touch. The modelling clay. It's got that just slightly tacky, damp feel, which is kind of appropriate, I think, for Wallace, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, really. It's the traditional stuff you used to play with as a child, that it's oil-based so that it never dries out. And it always remains, a little, like, oily, I guess. You know, it's sort of always a bit malleable and... not like something that dries out and becomes like pastry.
So, how did this particular project come about, this one, the proms?
Sir Albert Hall himself called up, in fact. So Wallace was quite chuffed about that. And to write a concerto, which, of course, Wallace always takes a challenge.
How do you rate him as a composer?
Not that highly, to be honest. But, you know, thankfully, Gromit was able to step in. Gromit especially just constantly surprises me with what he's got up his sleeve, you know, what talents he has.
Yes, I can't help wondering, you know, because of the mystery that perhaps, you know, we'll never find out, really, that what Wallace composed. You know, your mind, you know, maybe he uses sort of variations on Rule Britannia or variations on... You have a sort of feeling I have about him that he would be good at that and maybe not quite so good on... sort of a Mozartian kind of area.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he has a rather kind of mechanistic approach to most things, so it would probably involve brass in some ways and steam, I would have guessed.
Lovely cheese. I could just wash it down. Oh, I was just coming, lad.
So going right the way back to the beginning, Nick... where and how did Wallace and Gromit appear?
Well, they actually go back to my days at film school and art school to sketchbooks. I'm an avid keeper of sketchbooks. And I really had this, when I was trying to think of my graduation project at the National Film and TV School, I had this idea that it was a basic gag, really, was of this rather stupid guy that builds a rocket in the basement of his house. And the gag was that, well, that was it really. And I was going to have the rocket take off through the middle of the house in this kind of northern terraced row. It kind of developed from there, really. He was going to have a kind of sidekick, which was a cat at the time, called Gromit. When it came to making Gromit out of clay, I just found it easy to make a dog, really, because the limbs are longer and I could get my fingers around the different parts of him to animate him.
And were you a model maker? I mean, could you... was that something you had always done from being a child? Or?
Oh, yeah, I guess it starts a lot younger, really. I was always wanting to be a cartoonist. I wanted to work for the Beano when I was about 8 or 10 years old. I loved drawing cartoon strips. And then one day I discovered that my parents' home movie camera could do stop-frame animation, like one frame at a time, where you just move the thing, take a picture, move it again, and so forth. And so I tried drawn animation in sketch pads. I tried... cut out in paper or cardboard, and there was always modelling clay around the house, so I just animated anything I could find, really, and I kind of translated my characters into models quite quickly, and I was a fan of Ray Harryhouse and...
Jason and the Argonauts.
Jason and the Argonauts. The Wombles, you know, Noggin the Nog, you know, the Clangers, all that kind of thing, Bagpuss. And so I just emulated, and Morph, of course, and so I just emulated all these things.
There's something godlike, isn't there? You know, if you think of the descriptions of the creation of Adam and Eve, and in the Jewish tradition, the creating of the golem or the golem, it's Promethean, isn't it? The idea that you can create life, and we do, just in life and sex, but actually to animate inanimate objects was a dream for thousands of years of people. They've created these myths of taking clay and turning them into stuff that could move. It was like something crazy and wonderful. And then the movie industry basically were able to do this, something that had been prefigured in myth.
It is incredible. I mean, that reminds me of the days when I would do some animation on 8mm at home, and then, you wait 2 weeks to get the film back, sort of thing. And I remember just with my own simple version of Morph, projecting it onto my bedroom wall and watching it. It would flicker at, you know, 18 frames a second. And I just would watch this thing that I'd made actually moving in real time. And I remember being awestruck by it, that I couldn't believe that I'd done that and that there it was moving like a real thing. So it was like a real magic, like a real movie on the wall sort of thing.
I once worked with some children who took the word eat, put some teeth on the letter E,
yes,
and the E ate the other two letters. Yes? Right. So they moved with clay, flat on a table, shot it, and so the letter E then ate the A and the T, and then the E kind of went... so funny and so clever, and that they'd done that. And again, there was a sense of magic that, you know, the letter E, that letters could eat each other. It's that magic, you know, and I think in part children must sense that about the things that you make, that you've made these objects and you can see their objects.
I mean, ever since before I got involved with Aardman as well, I remember people saying, you know, everyone would go and see Disney films and before the days of computer animation, where you're talking about quite sophisticated techniques, where you're not really asked to look at the technique itself, and really elaborate films, you know. But as soon as they saw Morph, they'd say, oh, that's really clever, that Morph, even though the Disney films are probably far cleverer, really, with all they have involved.
So what's coming up in the second half?
Well, we're going to see Wallace and Gromit's latest short film, A Matter of Loaf and Death, which is half an hour, and it's going to be to a live orchestra.
Oh, right, that's like silent movies in the old days where there was a live pianist.
Yeah, and all the music is, of course, from the Wallace and Gromit composer, Julian Nott.
So is this something that might be seen elsewhere? Can it go on?
Well, yeah, I mean, if this is a success, we're hoping it's going to be taken up all over the world as a kind of travelling roadshow. You know, maybe we'll get a call from Sir Sydney Opera House or someone like that and take it around the world.
So might we see Wallace and Gromit on stage, or do you think they'll stay in the dressing room?
I think they'll stay in the dressing room because they do suffer from stage fright a little. They're a bit shy of standing up in front of people. You know, they're technicians. You know, artists, I guess, really.
Yes, no, I can see that about them. I was just slightly worried that the penguin was down there. I found myself just slightly just uneasy about that. There's no danger that the penguin would turn up and wreck things in any way, is there?
Are you sure he was there? I thought he was...
I saw him downstairs in the main entrance. He was just hiding behind...
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, you missed him, did you?
Yeah, have you alerted security about that?
On the way out.
Okay.
Don't worry. Security has been alerted, but you can never be too careful with that penguin, can you? Wallace and Gromit, A Feat of Clay, was presented by Michael Rosen and produced by Neil George. Welcome back to part two of our Wallace and Gromit Family Grom here at the Royal Albert Hall. In this second half of the concert, we're in the hall, we're going to see a screening of the film A Matter of Loaf and Death with, for the first time ever, live orchestral accompaniment from the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin. The music is composed by Julian Nott. It might help those of you at home, or those of you in the Albert Hall with your eyes shut, if I give you a synopsis of the film A Matter of Loaf and Death. So, our heroes, Wallace and Gromit, are running a bakery in a small, unidentified northern town, when a serial killer starts to murder all the local bakers one by one. While Wallace and Gromit are doing their bread delivery round, they spot a runaway bike. Wallace immediately recognises the cyclist. It's none other than the beautiful Paella Bakewell, who he remembers from years before as the Bako-like girl in a TV flower advert, floating through the air light as a feather in the Bako-like hot air balloon. But now, as her brakes have failed, she's in deep trouble. A short ride on a fast machine, if you like. Wallace and Gromit leap to the rescue, and they save Paella and her dog Fluffles from a snappy end as they hurtle towards the crocodile enclosure of the local zoo. Wallace is immediately smitten. Gromit, meanwhile, checks the brakes and they seem to work fine. He senses something fishy. As romance develops, Paella virtually moves in and fills the house with flowers. But all is not as it seems. When Paella forgets her purse, it's Gromit who's sent out in the rain to return it to her house. While there, he discovers mannequins with baker's hats on and a photo album with pictures of Paella with all the murdered bakers, 12 of them.
One to go for a baker's dozen, and that one will be Wallace. So, it's Paella who's the serial baker batterer. At this point, at home, you may feel free to hiss and boo. To avoid being found, Gromit has to hide in Paella's house overnight. When he returns home, he finds that Wallace and Paella have got engaged. He tries to warn Wallace and protects him with security devices, but Paella is too quick for him. She pretends that Gromit has bitten her, and Wallace chains him up. With Gromit out of the way, Paella attempts to kill Wallace, but he's saved by Fuffles, who you'll remember is the dog. Paella is furious, and for a moment, her mask slips. She reveals that she hates all bakers. Again, booing and hissing may well be in order here. But Paella quickly recovers, and she brings Wallace a present of a tea time cake. Wallace is taken in and forgives her. But this is no ordinary cake, as Paella has hidden a bomb in it. Determined not to be thwarted again, she manages to capture Gromit and Fluffy and lock them up. However, they manage to attempt to escape in the bake or light hot air balloon, but will they get to Wallace in time? I'll leave you to decide. You may never decide. I hope you do. Here. In a moment, the intrepid Nicholas Collen will come back on stage to conduct the Aurora Orchestra in a live performance of music with the film A Matter of Loaf and Death. I always think there's something a bit frightening about bakers anyway, the way they stand there in those aprons in very hot rooms. Ah, here's Nicholas Collen coming back onto the stage to conduct the Aurora Orchestra, and he isn't wearing a baker's apron, I'm pleased to say.
Welcome back. Now, many of you will know Wallace and Gromit's latest adventure, A Matter of Loaf and Death. But this afternoon's screening will be the first of its kind. The film will be accompanied live by our very own Aurora Orchestra. So sit back, fasten your seatbelts, and please give a big round of applause for A Matter of Loaf and Death.
Thanks, Chuck. Oh, Oh dear! Another baker. Battered with his own rolling pin. Huh? Would you credit it? Still, looking on the bright side, I suppose it means more business for us, eh, Gromit? We're on a roll, lad! Good day, Wilbur. Target. Gromit! Did you see who that was?
Help!
She's in trouble!
Oh, help! Oh, help!
Here, Gromit, take the wheel! Cakes, lad. The wholemeal fruit on me knees. Oh! I should have tried the granary rolls. Oh, hey! To be of help.
I must get those brakes seen to. We're so grateful, how Miss Nuffles. Nuffles!
Oh, it was nothing. what a lovely little doggie.
My name's Paella. Paella Bakewell.
Oh, I know who you are, Miss. Light as a feather, you're the baker-like girl.
Oh, that's me.
I'm Wallace. I'm inbred myself. Are you still ballooning, Miss?
I do beg your pardon.
Oh, no, I mean the Bakelite balloon. Do you still fly it?
Oh, I see. No, not anymore.
Well, back to the grind, as it were. Goodbye, Miss Bakewell.
Oh, I'd rather say au revoir.
Oh, oui, madame. And bon appetit.
Bye.
Oh, the Bakelite girl. Fancy that, Gromit. It's not every day you meet the girl of your dreams, is it? Oh, well, this isn't going to put bread on the table, is it? Oh, hello.
We were just passing by, going for a walk, and Fluffles insisted on dropping in, hoping you would join us. Please say yes. She'd be so disappointed. Wouldn't you, Fluffy? Wouldn't you, Fluffy?
Oh, well, if you insist. But I'm in my work things.
I like a man in uniform. Come on. Walkies!
Manage without me, won't you, lad?
Oh,
change, doesn't it, my fudge cake? Gromit's gonna love this.
Well, I thought you could do with a woman's touch around the house. You naughty, slovenly boys.
What do you think, Gromit? You wouldn't know it was our place, would you, lad? Love is a many splendid thing, Gromit, but it doesn't half tire you out. I'm cream crackered. Oh, heck! Pyreless purse. I must return it forthwith. Gromit?
Funny. I'm sure I heard something. Oh, there it is. He must have been there all along. Early night, Fluffles. Big day tomorrow. Our final baker is nicely buttered up.
Oh, hello, stranger. Where have you been? Hey, wait, hold your horses. I've got something to tell you first, old pal. Haven't we, dearest?
Of course, my little cheesecake. Wallace and I are engaged to be married. Till death do us part.
I think congratulations might be in order, lad.
Oh, I can see he's dying to give me a great big kiss. I know we're going to get on like a house on fire. One big, happy family.
Come in, my sponge cake.
What's going on?
You'll have to forgive him, my petal. He's been a bit security conscious of late.
Well, you can't be too careful these days, can you? What with a serial killer on the loose?
Oh, yes.
A nice spot of cockaleeky soup.
Oh, smashing! I've got just the bread to go with it. Hey, what the? That dog. Smells delicious.
Oh, I do hope you like it, my short crust. It's my own special recipe.
What the? Hey, what are you playing that like? This is getting ridiculous.
Oh, Wallace, he just wants a bit of attention, that's all. Now, my little hoochie-woochie, let Auntie Paya sort you out. Ow! Ow! He bit me!
Hey?
I was just trying to help and he bit me, Wallace.
Gromit! How dare you bite my betrothed? That's very impolite.
Oh, don't be too hard on him, Wallace, please. Just a little punishment, that's all.
I'm surprised at you, Gromit. I really am.
Oh, Wallace, my sugar dumpling. Have you got a mo?
Oh, on my way, my cupcake. You'll not leave this kitchen till you've done every last one. I don't know. Taking a bite out of my lovely fiancé. It really is the limit.
I'm such a silly sausage. It just sort of fell off my foot.
Stay well back, my precious. Leave it to me.
Oh, you're so brave, Wallace. My minced pie.
It. Huh? Oh. Are you all right, my flower? Oh, flower! Get it? A flower?
Get your hands off me! I hate flour, I hate bread, and I hate bakers! You utter and complete fruitcake!
Oh. Oh, that's a bit steep, isn't it, my sweet?
Fluffles? I want a word with you. Back home.
Oh, thanks, old pal. I just don't get it. One minute they love bakers, and the next minute they hate them. And I'm not a fruitcake, am I, lad? I suppose you can't be everybody's cup of tea, can you? Oh!
I'm so sorry, Wallace. So, so sorry. I don't know what came over me. Apart from the flower, of course.
Oh, yes.
Let's forget about it. Here's a cake to celebrate. Oops, must be my keys.
Celebrate?
Us, getting back together again, you gooseberry fool.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. We could have that with our 4 o'clock tea. Won't you join us?
Oh, I would. Fluffles isn't feeling too well. Why don't you two celebrate? Let's fly.
Oh, roll on 4 o'clock, eh? This'll go down a treat. Grommet.
I'll deal with you two later.
Come on, lad. Ha, what's keeping you?
At last. My 13th. My baker's dozen. And curse that prevailing southwesterly. They'll be there in no time.
I'll strike a light. Oh, there you are. I think these matches are a bit damp. Ah, yes. It's one of those junk candles, lad. Where are you going with that? Grommet, it's a bomb! The cake's a bomb! Wait a minute. You don't think Paella could be...
the serial killer. Well done, Wallace. Sharp as a brick. Now do exactly as I say or Fluffles get snuffled. Cross me once too often, you treacherous little...
Get that thing away, lad! That's it, lad. Use your loaf. You're the baker-like girl.
Was the baker-like girl. I ate too much, you see.
Oh, really?
I couldn't ride the balloon anymore.
Oh, dear.
So they dropped me.
What a blow. Oh.
May a curse on bakers and their loathsome confections.
Grommet!
Huh? What?
Lad. It has.
Come to Mummy, Fluffy Wuffy. About me, lad. I'm fully in control. Anyone seen the bomb? What?
Bomb by Art Wallace. Your bombs are as good as toasted.
Oh, Grummy! I've got a bomb in me pants. Help me, Grummy. Do something. It tickles! Farewell, my angel cake. You'll always be my Bakelite girl. I think I need a cup of tea after all that. Care to join me, you two? Never mind, lad. We've both been through the mill this week, haven't we? But at least yours wasn't a bread-hating, baker-murdering serial killer, like mine. Tell me what, lad. Let's go and deliver some bread, eh? That'll cheer us up. Always room for a small one. On the wheel, lad. Concentrate.
happy ending for Wallace and Gromit. The evil pile of Bakewell, too heavy now for the Bakelite hot air balloon, sinks into the crocodile enclosure at the zoo and is never seen again. Meanwhile, Gromit's new doggy friend Fluffles joins them on their baker's round and everything gets back to normal. Music by Julian Knott, performed live by the Aurora Orchestra, conductor Nicholas Collin. And the audience are going wild in a family kind of way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, it's hard to keep up with Wallace and Gromit, but I think they appear to have got through unscathed from this afternoon's adventure. What a wonderful time we've all had listening to such fabulous music and watching our friends on the big screen. Few thanks. Let's have a special round of applause for the composer of the music for A Matter of Loaf and Death, who's here today, Julian Knott. And that tune's going to be going around in your head for a few days. We're delighted that here with us this afternoon are the creator of Wallace and Gromit, Nick Park, and creative director Merlin Crossingham. And a huge round of applause, please, to our very own Aurora Orchestra. A couple of other people to thank, and you know who they are. But before we say thank you to Wallace and Gromit's violin, I think they might have a few words to say.
You really should take more care of this, you know, lad. It's priceless. Go on, lad. Open it. It won't bite. Well done, Pooch. Oh, yes. We'd just like to say a big thanks to all of you for making this such a cracking concert. Yeah, really was cracking. Oh, fiddle. Ever thought of trying the bassoon, lad?
In a kind of comedy disaster as Wallace sat on Gromit's precious violin. The audience are applauding wildly here for Nicholas Collin and the Aurora Orchestra. What a fantastic afternoon we've had. We've been taking pictures during the afternoon concert, and I'm pleased to say they'll be available very soon on the BBC Proms website, which is of course bbc.co.uk/proms. Nicholas Collin is receiving a bouquet. It doesn't appear to be made of bread, but perhaps it is. It's nice to see Nick Park here, of course, the creator of Wallace and Gromit, 20 years ago today. I bet he never thought when he first started that one day they'd star at the Albert Hall. It's been a wonderful, wonderful afternoon. Don't forget, you can listen to it for up to a week after broadcast on the BBC iPlayer. And perhaps next time something different will happen in the film, because you never know with that kind of thing. Well, that's all now from the Royal Albert Hall. I'm off for a loaf of bread. I'll hand you back to David Cornett in Broadcasting House.
And that was Ian McMillan. And as Ian said, you can listen again in high definition sound from the Radio 3 homepage. Perhaps you've got children who are at the concert this afternoon and they'll be able to listen again. Well, we'll be going back to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom this evening at 8 o'clock, when Mark Elder conducts the Aldborough World Orchestra in music by Britten, Mahler and Stravinsky. And that concert will be previewed at 6:15 this evening. That's in, 40 minutes' time or so, in a Proms Plus event, which will be broadcast live from the Royal College of Music.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, two iconic American works. And two composers from the old world harness the emotive force of the African-American spiritual. Tippett's A Child of Our Time, alongside music by Ives, Zimmerman and Samuel Barber. Wednesday night at the BBC Proms, starting at 7:30.
Well, coming up next this afternoon, one of BBC Radio 3's new generation artists will be performing. She'll be singing in Elgar's Sea Pictures. That's coming up in about 1/4 hour's time. And before that, guitar music. Music not written for guitar, it was written by Johann Sebastian Bach. It's the Chaconne from his Partita No. 2 in D minor, played by Michael Kendrick.
Thank you.
Michael Kendrick playing the Chaconne from the Partita No. 2 in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. Well, it's 11 minutes to 6 now. This is BBC Radio 3. Time to meet more of the best in young musical talent. Over to Clemency Burton-Hill.
Hello and thanks for joining me for the next in our series here on Radio 3, exploring the current breadth of talent on the BBC New Generation Artists Scheme. If you were listening to our Taster programme a couple of weeks ago, you'll have heard mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnston singing Schubert. Tonight, our focus is back on Jennifer, as she's joined by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Martin Brabins to perform a single work, Elgar's song cycle, Sea Pictures. The cycle consists of settings of 5 poems by various authors: Sea Slumber Song, In Haven, Sabbath Morning at Sea, Where Corals Lie, and The Swimmer, which all evoke a range of moods from the tranquil to the tempestuous. Elgar was criticised at the time for using songs which some felt verged on the edge of drawing room balladry, but the work has proved enduringly popular with mezzo-sopranos. I caught up with Jennifer recently and asked her why she was drawn to the cycle.
The Sea Pictures lies very much within my core repertory, really. There aren't very many cycles like it, certainly in terms of its scale. Full of variety, full of colour, full of change from movement to movement, and actually very beautifully written for the voice. Certainly Elgar understood a lower female voice. It means that you can sing it without too much pressure. You know, it's a bit daunting to start with, but actually wonderful, and I would happily sing it over and over again. The BBC Scottish Symphony are an extraordinary orchestra, but also it was a total joy to work with Brabins. He's amazing and totally understands English repertoire and the ebb and flow that you require in Elgar. It was a real privilege to work with them on it.
Well, here they are now, BBC New Generation artist Jennifer Johnston with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra conducted by Martin Brabins in Elgar's Sea Pictures.
Loosen!
BBC New Generation artist Jennifer Johnston performing Elgar's Sea Pictures. She was joined by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Martin Brabins. Well, if you enjoyed that and would like to see more of Jennifer in action, there's a fantastic clip of her performing Brahms's Rote Abendwolken from his Zigeunerlieder. That's up on the New Generation artist's webpage. You can access that by bbc.co.uk/radio3/NGA. That's it from me this evening. I'll be back with another New Generation Artists special next Sunday afternoon, when I'll be joined by soprano Ruby Hughes, who'll be treating us to a programme of Fauré and Berg not to be missed. I hope you'll join us then.
Today's New Generation Artist was presented by Clemency Burton Hill.
The BBC World Roots Academy Late Night Prom.
At the age of 13, I decided to play the accordion because I saw this master on the accordion that came from Colombia. First time I saw that accordion, that sound, I said, wow, I really want to play that now.
20-year-old Colombian accordion player José Hernando Noguera and friends perform the traditional music of his Latin American heritage. The World Roots Academy Late Night Prom, live on BBC Radio 3 on Tuesday night at 10:15.
Trust me, they will dance to it.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3, it's 6:15, and now live from the Royal College of Music, Proms Plus, presented this evening by Stephen Johnson.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this Proms Plus talk. We're joined tonight by members of the Aldeburgh World Orchestra, Tamsin Thorne, bassoon, Matisha Panagoda, cello, and Andrew Somerville, saxophone, and also by the composer, Charlotte Bray, who'll be talking to us a little later on about her own piece, At the Speed of Stillness, which is also featuring for the first time in tonight's programme. This is a genuine premiere here. First of all, though, we thought we'd have a look at the other works in the programme first in detail and get a performer's eye view, because it's always interesting to hear what it's like to be on the inside, I think, of this, particularly for those of us who aren't musicians. And we'll start with The Briton, the Symphonia de Requiem. This, as I'm sure many of you are aware, was composed in 1940. The British Council asked Britain to write a work celebrating the 2,600th anniversary of the Japanese imperial dynasty. At this stage, Japan and the UK were not at war. Britain was very anxious to avoid jingoism, so he chose titles from the Mass from the Dead, the Requiem Mass, as a reflection of the terrible times that they were living in. This turned out to be a major diplomatic blunder, because the Japanese authorities were extremely offended by the use of Christian dogma, as they called it, in a work designed for performance in Imperial Japan. This was an insult, apparently. So the work was not performed in Japan. It was premiered in the New York in 1941 and in London in 1942. At the same time as wanting to reflect the difficult and dangerous times that he was living in at the time of the Second World War, Britton was thinking of something rather more personal, too. He composed the work, he said, in memory of my parents. So this is a work that's poised, as it were, between reflecting terrible, catastrophic world events and something much more personal. You get a sense of that right from the beginning of the work. The beginning, you have a huge sense of devastation, of desolation, so these pounding noises, rather like gunfire, like shells, or maybe like a tolling bell. This is how the symphony begins. Well, we've already got the cello and the bassoon, Tammy and Mathesia here. So I'd like to talk to you about something that it's often said that Britain has an unusual empathy with instruments, that he writes as though he played your instrument, even though he didn't. That sounds like wonderful cello writing, Mathesia. Is it as wonderful to play as it is to listen to?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I think he writes really nicely for the cello. There's no awkward passages in it. It all fits really well under the hand. And I think he had written some other cello repertoire, and he had a good relationship with Rostropovich, so he had a good idea of how to write well for the instrument.
But he knows exactly which note is where, doesn't he? I mean, if you just play the opening, it's beautifully placed on the cello, isn't it? Sounds as if he knows exactly what colour it's going to make and on which string.
It's
hard to believe he wasn't a cellist in some ways, isn't it? What about your solo that follows that, Tammy? It's much more sort of, how does that fit on the bassoon?
Well, it's quite nice because it's in the middle of the instrument. There's nothing too difficult or scary about it, which is quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, actually, the whole part, there's nothing in it which is really difficult or really tricky. It all actually sits very well, very comfortably on the fingers. It's very,
but
very
again,
well written.
The colour just goes with the expression. Perhaps you could just play a little bit of that solo for
sure.
Us. It's just... It couldn't be anything else but bassoon, really. It's beautifully conceived. But I think you were saying earlier on, when we were talking in the green room, that there was one little passage that gave you a slight scare, or you had to... Perhaps it was in the second movement, I think.
In this one. Oh, yes, there are a few. There's lots of trills, and there's something... There is flutter tongue written in for us, and actually that's quite difficult to do on some pitches because it's quite a high note, but there's a note at the bottom that it says where it's flutter tongue, if it's impractical, use a semitone trill.
It's Britain's practicality. I mean, he was a remarkably good conductor, and he did learn from his experience as a conductor, but obviously he maybe discovered in rehearsal that this wasn't perhaps the ideal
to write for
the bassoon.
Yeah.
And what about now? There is one other, of course, important colour in the wind section of Britain's Sinfonia de Requiem, which is, well, an unusual guest, certainly in the time that Britain wrote this, an unusual guest in the orchestra. Let's just hear a little bit of this on CD. Unmistakable sounds of the alto saxophone, and we've got here Andy Somerville with his alto saxophone, and it's beautiful saxophone writing, isn't it? It's gorgeous.
It's amazing because I just think that the playing that Britain would have heard in this country at that stage, it's so refined.
Well, this is the thing. Most composers in Britain's time who were writing for the saxophone use it as a kind of imitation jazz instrument, don't they, at the time? There's no kind of overlay of jazz in this saxophone writing at all. He's got something else in mind.
I think so. I think every time it comes in, the colour is so unexpected and kind of almost eerily arresting that it really creates an atmosphere. And that There's something unsettling about it. The orchestral colour is so unfamiliar, I think, and then there's all of a sudden this other noise.
Perhaps you could just play us a little bit of that solo as well, because
it's a little bit less vibrato than that.
Give it a little bit less vibrato recording. Than that recording we've just heard, yes, okay. Is that as beautiful to play as it sounds?
It's actually rather tricky. The tuning is really hard. I've got a bunch of alternative fingerings in there to try and make it match the rest of the wind section.
It's interesting because the saxophone, it kind of stands apart, doesn't it, from the rest of the wind section. Do you think that was what he had in mind? Do you think he's thinking of you as a kind of lone voice in a way?
I think so, because it always introduces some kind of contrasting material throughout the piece. Every time we come in with something important, I do play the similar material often with the bass clarinet and horns, or a string melody, I think Sir Mark said, really just so that the winds could hear what's going on. Whenever there's something prominent, it's a very contrasting idea, and you always end up sat sort of outside of the bass clarinet on your own. So.
There's a very nice example of that we can set up on CD from the second movement, the Dies Irae, which is very, very fast and furious. But the saxophone is playing still as though it was in the tempo and in the mood of the first movement. So you really do sound as though you're a voice from another world here. Perhaps we could just hear a bit of that. That's a really eerie passage, isn't it? You completely stand out from everybody else. And we got a little bit of the flutter tongue that Tammy hates as well there, which you may have noticed in the background. Then next work in the programme is the Adagio from Mahler's last symphony, his 10th symphony. It turns out that Mahler was a lot closer to completing his 10th symphony than most people believed. And the work is almost performable as it stands. There's a performing version by Derek Cook. But the first movement, the Adagio, was very nearly complete in an orchestral score, and it's often performed on its own. It does make a very satisfying statement in its own right. Mahler is a very apt composer to follow the Sinfonia de Requiem with, because he was a huge influence on Britain at a time when Mahler wasn't actually that highly esteemed in this country. In fact, it's easy to forget that for a lot of Mahler's life, and for some time afterwards, a lot of people knew him as a great conductor who also composed, to which many would have added, unfortunately. That's including Alma Mahler's father, Mahler's wife. When she asked her father what she thought about Mahler as a composer, he said, "Well, it's no good, I'm afraid. Don't keep away from that. How things have changed." But, well, the 10th symphony is pretty remarkable from whichever way you look at it, because, for one thing, it begins with a very unusual, not a solo, but a completely unaccompanied passage for a department of the orchestra that doesn't normally get to begin symphonies, and that's the violas. But of many, many jokes in orchestras, not always entirely aptly, I'm afraid. But let's just hear a bit of the beginning of the symphony so you can hear how Mahler uses the sound of the violas to set up the tone of this last, of this first movement. We've got Mathisha here, who's our representative of the cello set of the string section. Mathisha, it really is rather unusual to give the violas the spotlight like that, and unaccompanied at the beginning of a symphony, isn't it?
Yeah, it happened so many times as well. I'm a little bit jealous.
in this movement, yeah, they do get the spotlight. But the string writing is, the strings are absolutely central to Mahler's orchestral sound, aren't they? And, well, what are the demands? What is it that's particularly demanding about this kind of string writing for you? Is it the technical side, or is it more the expression? Because he really does demand a full-on emotional engagement, doesn't he, Mark?
Yeah, there are a few technical passages, but I think the biggest challenge is getting a really unified sound in the string section, and that's something we've worked very hard at over the last few weeks, being a new orchestra coming together. It's so nice to play this music. It's really rich texture in the strings, and you really feel part of a big section playing. So it's not so fiddly and technical, but it's great.
Clearly. Well, let's hear a little bit of the passage that follows that one at the beginning, just to show how strong the contrast is when Mahler does bring in the full strings supported by the trombones. This is the main theme of the first movement, the theme that contrasts with that viola solo. So on into even more contrasting movement, strange, nebulous sounds that follow it. Mathisha, Mahler was a conductor. Do you feel, as with Britten, when you play his music, that he really understands your instrument, that he's got that kind of musician's understanding?
Yeah, I do. And I think what I was saying about the whole string section being one kind of big body, you really get a sense of that in this music. It's on like a very monumental scale, I think.
Yeah.
You know, being part of that is... Yeah, you really feel part of a big section.
He did like big sounds, didn't he?
He did.
Apparently,
yes.
When he heard Niagara Falls for the first time, he said, "Fortissimo at last." So, now, but there's a very different kind of cello writing shortly after this, that passage that we've just heard there, where you take on, instead of being lyrical and warm, there's a very sardonic side to this movement as well, sarcastic and rather bleak. Mm. And there's some very slightly, I wouldn't say awkward, but rather angular cello writing. I wonder if you could give us a bit of a flavour of that. Yes, actually, you make it sound rather beautiful, like that, actually, I have to say, but it's still that chromaticism, that edginess, it's unusual in string writing of the time.
Yeah.
And Tammy, you have some lovely contributions to make to this kind of sardonic mood in the Adagio of Mahler.
Yeah.
Particularly, there are some rather nice noises that you make right down towards the bottom of your register. I wonder if you give
them
a little demonstration of that.
Yeah, sure.
And Mahler seems to understand the sarcastic side of the bassoon sometimes, doesn't he?
Yes, I think so, yes.
He does write that, and then I think a bar and a half later, you're right at the top of the of your range, aren't you?
Yeah, well, it's not too high. It's not quite as high as the Rye Spring, for instance, but it's... Yeah, he does write, there's quite a range. It does cover lots of this piece is in the middle of the bassoon. Mm. So it's quite comfortable, but it's quite a large range, yeah.
Yeah, could you just give us your top note there?
Yeah.
Well, you make it sound quite easy. I know it's not.
It's not the nicest bit. It's quite random as well, that bit. It's just that.
Once on its own, isn't
that's
it? One
color. Yeah.
In the middle of it, yes, after those low
we
notes.
We do nothing for a while and then we have that and then nothing for a bit.
it's one of those things where you think maybe he isn't thinking too much
of
what it's like
Marla,
to be in
the
bassoon. Yeah, okay, fair enough. But it's interesting about this sort of picking out of high register notes like that because that's the same note that famously at the climax of this movement, maybe this is a kind of subconscious plant that the trumpet holds in the astonishing climax of this movement where Mahler piles up dissonances on the full orchestra which are quite unlike anything in his music up till then. This is 1910 when he wrote the Tenth Symphony. Perhaps we could just hear a bit of the climax of this adagio.
Thank you.
Yes, it really is quite a scary moment, that, isn't it? I see you both nodding there. Mathisha, is this sort of, you have to prepare yourself for something like that.
Yeah, it kind of comes out of nowhere as well. One interesting thing about this piece is that there's lots of changes in character, and you have to be ready to just go from the viola solo to
sudden
into
changes,
this.
Aren't they? They're like sort of almost like a cut from one shot to another. You know,
sudden,
one,
but
one
they could feel seamless. You know, it's
yeah, absolutely.
A challenge.
You're nodding too, Tammy.
That's my favourite part of the piece, actually. Mm. I just think it's amazing because it's so quiet before that. It's just the violins doing. So that's really quiet, really delicate, and then everyone just comes crashing in.
It should be amazing in the Albert Hall.
It's really
hall,
fun as well,
yes,
actually.
I mean, because it's one of those absolutely riveting pianissimos, and you think, can this get any quieter? And then suddenly, wham, in comes the full orchestra, I think, for the first time altogether on that chord.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous, dramatic moment. After this, of course, and then we have a work that calls for an even bigger orchestra than Mahler's Tenth Symphony, and that's Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, a famously big orchestra. And this, of course, is where Tammy has her golden moment, or her supreme scary moment, depending on whichever way you look at it. Because there you are, you're in the Royal Albert Hall, and this huge orchestra with 20 woodwind, I think 18 brass, huge percussion, plenty of strings, is sitting there. And what does it begin with?
Me.
Just one note, very quietly, on the bassoon. There's an interesting story about this solo at the beginning. Stravinsky apparently was inspired to write it by, he was on a train in Lithuania, and he was an old man sitting opposite who just suddenly began to sing a folk song. And there was something about the sound of this old man's very cracked, high, but extremely expressive voice that made him think that he wanted an instrument right at the top of its register. So he thought, bassoon. But anyway, Tammy, I'm going to ask you to, if you wouldn't mind, just giving us a sample of the opening solo, this terrifying opening solo of The Rite of Spring. Imagine. All eyes are on Tammy now. One thing I noticed, Tammy, is you did not make that sound like the cracked voice of an old man on a train. You made it sound very beautiful.
Thank
now,
you.
Is it possible that actually bassoons and bassoon players these days are just getting too good for this solo? That the effect that Stravinsky wanted is of someone really at the edge of their straining at the top of the register is actually doesn't come out so naturally anymore?
Yeah, I think when it was first written, it was almost impossible. So it sounded kind of almost screeching, high, really hard, bit ugly. And I've heard people say that if it's to keep it authentic, it would have to go up by a semitone every 10 years or something to actually keep it difficult. But I'm quite glad it hasn't, to be honest. But I think it's more that the instruments have got better, the instruments have changed, the players have got better, and now it's actually it's fine.
It's absolutely fine. Well, it's not exactly
grade
one, is it?
It's quite scary.
Yeah.
But it's actually quite nice to play, I think, really.
You enjoy it.
I love playing high. I think the bassoon sounds just really lovely.
It's interesting because a lot of people think of the bassoon as a bass instrument, but actually, naturally, it tends to rise, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what I like about the bassoon, because it does it all. And we get quite often we're still doing the bass line, and we don't have the most exciting parts or the most important parts. But then when we do have a solo, it's a whopping great one like this one. So it's all or nothing. It's either absolutely fine, no pressure, or really scary.
Yeah.
So it's exciting life.
Well, good luck tonight.
Thank you very much.
But what about the strings? I mean, now Mathisha, Mahler loves the strings. He revels in the warmth. He revels in their expressive quality. He loves the way the cellos sing. Stravinsky's got a very different attitude to the strings, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. I think they have more of a perhaps percussive role, rhythmic role in a lot of Stravinsky's music here. It's not always melodic. You have a lot of the nice melodies to the woodwinds, but we have some great bits. They're just not so melodic.
Well, actually, let's just sample a few of those on CD first, and then maybe you can talk us through them. Perhaps the most famous moment of all, the beginning of the first fast dance, the Augurs of Spring and the Rite of Spring, and these wonderful chords with these offbeat stresses. Strings, but certainly not as Mahler was expected to hear them. ¶¶ Yes, it seems that everybody's got a tune there except you, Mathisha.
Pretty much, yeah.
The bassoons, even the tubas at one point, but not you. How do you get that extraordinary percussive sound that's so different from the Mahler?
It's interesting. That's something that we worked a lot at over the past few weeks, because different sections, he's quite descriptive in the way he writes. For instance, in this section, he writes, you know, all day.